had a scissors in my hand. I struck at him. I ran away. He was lying in the hall. Blood around him.
Your sister, Mary, is a murderess.
I don't believe it.
You go back to school, then forget Chocolate.
Drink it, Jacqueline. There's nothing else for you to do. They say you've got to die.
I run to death, and death meets me as fast, and all my pleasures are like yesterday. That is the sonnet from John Donne that opens The Seventh Victim, producer Val Lewton's fourth film in his series for RKO. The Seventh Victim stars Kim Hunter, Streetcar Named Desire, and Zira from Planet of the Apes, as a young girl named Mary Gibson who is attending a boarding school. She's told by the school's headmistress that the payments that usually come from her sister Jacqueline have stopped, which means Mary would have to leave. Mary gets the idea to head to New York and find her sister, who seems to have disappeared. Once there, Mary learns about Jacqueline's mysterious life in the city. She rented a small apartment above a restaurant, but inside it, it is only a chair and a noose. Jacqueline had been running a successful cosmetics company, but sold her half to her partner, eventually taking up with a group of Satanists. She also started to visit a psychiatrist named Dr. Judd, played by Tom Conway, who plays the same Judd who appeared in Lewton's earlier film, Cat People, and revealed the existence of the cult to him. This was an unforgivable breach of the code, and so they have issued a fatwa on Jacqueline. There have been six previous members of the cult who have died because of their dalliance with the group, making Jacqueline the seventh victim. The Seventh Victim is a film that I think is a sort of mini masterpiece, although I'd be hard-pressed to sort of defend it in some ways, because for a film that is only 70 minutes long, it has extraneous characters, it has plot threads that don't go anywhere. It has some actual sort of plot mistakes, because apparently there was a longer version of the film that was edited down to the one we got. And yet, this film retains, to me, a hypnotic pull and is still incredibly frightening for a 1943 movie made on a very low budget. So, David, why do you love The Seventh Victim so much?
I guess that's kind of changed over the years, because I've seen it quite a few times during the course of my life. You know, I think I first encountered it on PBS in the 80s. And at the time, I wouldn't have had some of the references that I've sort of latched onto in thinking about the movie. At first, I guess I just thought it was fascinating and kind of puzzling. And maybe, you know, it didn't loom as large at that time, for sure, I would say. But when I rewatched it, when I got the Val Lewton box set, I had, in the meantime, seen a lot of other movies. You know, this was came out in like 2005 or so.
Something like that.
Yeah, and one of the main things that I had seen and become like a huge fan of is Mulholland Drive by David Lynch. And I feel like, you know, it has some of the same interesting qualities that a David Lynch film has. It really is a David Lynch film avant la lettre, you know? And I wouldn't have known that when I saw it when I was like 11. But the more you think about it and the more you sort of try to puzzle your way into its intricacies, and even the production history is kind of similar. Because I don't know if you know Mulholland Drive.
No, I've never seen it.
Oh, I highly recommend it. It is my favorite film of all time.
Wow.
it's a movie. It came out in 2001, and you know, it's a movie that many people have many different theories about, and it doesn't have one particular meaning, I don't think, although there are many people who have kind of settled on a series of narrative interpretations that work. But the production history of it is that it was going to be a TV series that Lynch was going to do.
I think I heard that, yeah.
Yeah, and then the funding was pulled from it. And then he was like, well, I've got all this footage. I've got, like, you know, a 12-episode story to tell here. I had all these threads that I was going to, you know, embroider throughout the course of the series. And instead, I'm going to turn it into a 2.5-hour feature film that, you know, leads into a bunch of different dreams and impossible realities. And that kind of similar, like the sort of loose ends that I think, I guess, you know, it's understandable that these would detract from some people's enjoyment of it. I think that's partly what I love so much about The Seventh Victim, that it feels like so much has been left out and left to the imagination. And, you know, the Lewton movies in general, they're sort of renowned for the producer's sort of dictum that it's scarier when you don't know, when you never see the monster. And this right. is like just taking it further. You don't even see the plot. Yeah, so I don't know. That's a good beginning of why I'm so interested in it anyway, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I should mention for anyone who's not familiar with Val Lewton, who unfortunately he's kind of gotten forgotten over time. I mean, you mentioned the box set that came out about a decade ago, and it was really great that I thought that they found all of, well, at least all of his horror films and yeah. dusted them off, because he does have two other films that that he did for RKO that are still basically buried somewhere because they're not horror films. But Val Lewton is one of the few producers that you could really call an auteur, even though yeah. he himself never directed a single movie. But all his movies have a very similar thematic preoccupation with death, with, you know, mostly death, really. I mean, he was apparently a very sort of intense guy and a gloomy guy. He was very easily insulted, and he was very sort of passive aggressive. There's a famous story about that he would wear this purple tie to meetings, and it was such a hideous tie that if you didn't recognize that it was a hideous tie, he knew you were an idiot, because how dare you be able to sit there with this, I'm wearing this hideous tie and you're not coming. But he was also fiercely loyal. And again, we'll just get into the briefest backstory for Val Lewton. Basically, he got hired by RKO to make these cheapy horror films, and they had market tested these titles. So they handed Lewton his first title called Cat People. They had no story, they had nothing, they just had a title. And they said, okay, Val, make a movie. And they gave him no direction, no nothing, and they didn't even really care. They just wanted a movie called Cat People. So he goes and he makes this movie called Cat People, directed by Jacques Tourneur. And it's this very strange movie about a woman that turns into a cat basically when she gets sexually excited. It's really pretty out there for, again, for a 1942 movie. Cat People makes a ton of money because you never actually see because they didn't have the budget, you never actually see any monsters. It's all suggestion. It's all shadows. It's all it's all in your imagination. And it really clicked with people. And Cat People became a huge hit. He did a second film, I Walked with a Zombie. That became a hit. And RKO basically just kept up with that formula where they would give him a title and he could go and make whatever movie he wanted to. So by the time he gets to The Seventh Victim, he is ready, RKO is ready to promote him to the A-League. They are saying, you know, you're making these movies for like $300,000 and they're making $10 million. We'll make you, we're going to give you bigger budgets. We're going to give you bigger stars. You're going to be an A-list director. And The Seventh Victim is supposed to be the first film of that A-level production. He then wanted to hand the film to the director, Mark Robeson, who was one of his editors. And this would have been Robeson's first film. Robeson, of course, went on to a great career with Von Ryan's Express and Peyton Place. I mean, he had a great, long, long career. But this was his first film. And RKO was aghast. They're like, you're not going to handle an A picture to a first-time director. And so he drew a line in the sand and said, no, I got to make it with Robeson. And they said, well, if you stick with Robeson, you're going to be stuck in the B unit. We're not going to give you the A-level budget. And he said, fine, I'll stick to the B unit. And he stuck with Robeson, and it turned out really well because this is an extraordinary movie. Now, I think maybe, you know, Val Lewton must have known that he could have never gotten this movie produced on an A budget.
Yeah, no way. No way. The censors would have destroyed it.
I mean, you know, it features, I mean, good Lord. And first of all, it has a female protagonist. The Kim Hunter is the main character. The film opens on the same set that Orson Welles used for The Magnificent Ambersons, which that always charms me because now they don't do that anymore. They just destroy the sets or they're all out of CG anyway. But she's on The Magnificent Ambersons set. And literally the first time you see her, she is flowing upstream. She is heading up the stairs and the entire rest of the school is going downstairs. And to me, that sets the tone for this character. Because, yeah, you know, her, Mary Gibson, is for someone who seems very timorous. I mean, she's only supposed to be about 18 or 17 or 18. She's in a girl's school. She's tough. She goes to New York on her own, and there, I mean, she is just absolutely unafraid to go into the darkest corners of the city to investigate this group of Satanists, all to find her sister. And it's a very, it's, you know, it's funny. I think this is one of these films that, like, I think needs to be discovered by feminists.
Oh, it's like, absolutely.
You know, it's like she's a really great feminist character, and yet still most people don't have, you've never even heard of this movie.
Yeah, no, I think it. She is one of the great 40s feminist protagonists. I mean, she has like a couple of, you know, really signature moments. I mean, we could get to them as we go along, I guess. But yeah, the school is fascinating too. The headmistress, I guess, her name is Miss Lowood, which is the name of the, you know, horrible institution in Jane Eyre.
Right.
and obviously this was a touchstone for Lewton already, because I Walk with a Zombie is adapted from Jane Eyre, kind of. And so it's a really sinister place, but she seems to have fond feelings about it as well. Like, it's a very conflicted departure she has from the school. She's given this ominous warning from one of the sub-teacher, or the assistant mistress there, who's like, you know, don't come back, Mary, you must get out of here, don't return to the cloister, you have to really have courage and live in the world. And so Mary is like, you know, she's sets her jaw to do this, but she's, you know, she takes her farewell from the school with this sort of smile at the old clock, and you get the sense that she had some good times there. But the whole thrust of the atmosphere of the movie is to give you the sense that she's like getting out of there just in time to avoid a terrible fate, you know?
Yeah, the warning she's given by the as you said, the sub head of the school is very straightforward, where she says, "Don't do what I did."
Yeah,
you know, don't, because I'm basically saying, she's basically saying, "I'm trapped here."
Yeah,
you have
really
a chance to get out. It's very dark and ominous for a character that basically just gets that one scene. She doesn't have any other dialogue in the movie because we never see them again.
Yeah, and this school has that John Donne quote on their stained glass.
That's right.
What kind of school is this?
Yeah, I mean, Lewton really loved putting these, you know, weird dark quotes and things. And we talk about how brave Mary is. When eventually she goes to the city and she meets a private detective named Irving August.
Oh, like, yeah, that guy's great.
Lou Lubin, who looks like every character actor from the 1940s. He just has that look to him.
Yeah.
And so they decide to investigate the offices of the
the Missing Persons Bureau.
The Missing Persons Bureau. And they want to find stuff about Jacqueline. And they go at night. And there's this amazing scene where they're down this long hallway, and she tells Irving August, "Well, you know, the information is probably
in the locked room.
You should probably go in there, or Mr. August. It would be fine." And you know this is the wrong thing to do because it's terrifying. And yet she manages to convince this experienced gumshoe to basically risk his life. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, the whole setup is because she meets him at the Bureau of Missing Persons, and he is like lurking around looking to make a buck off someone who's, you know, desperately looking for a loved one. And that scene I find really incredible too. Like, it pans along all these people talking about, you know, the people who have gone missing from their lives.
All those sad stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. And so he just sort of appears out of nowhere, and he's like, "I can find your sister. I know every part of this town." And so she has no money, and he is going to – and then he's warned off by a mysterious sort of cancer man type figure.
Yeah.
And then he's like, "Wow, there must be all kinds of money in it," or that's the sort of the wheels turning in his head. That's what you assume. He is going to take advantage of this and get rich on it. But no, she totally takes charge of his life and ultimately sends him to his death.
Right. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, again, that's like another aspect of, like, so she seems like she's this sort of ingenue babe in the woods character, but time after time she defies that expectation. And, you know, sometimes by being brave herself and sometimes just by, you know, ordering other people to take risky chances that are going to get them killed. Like, she takes on more of, you know, guilt for what happens than you would usually assume an ingenue would have as well.
Yeah.
It's a very well-rounded presentation for a character that kind of comes and goes from the actual film.
Yeah, there's a big chunk where she disappears because they do the whole stuff with Jacqueline. But yeah, you mentioned Irving August gets killed. Yeah, so he comes out of the office and he's sort of staggering and he's not saying anything. And she's like, Mr. August. And then he keels over and you find out that he's been stabbed. So
And a little blood trickles out.
And so he's there and, you know, and to me, I'm even doubly terrified of the idea that whoever stabbed him is still in that office.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't seem even all that concerned about it. She's worried about Irving August. It's like, well, the guy is still in there, you know? And it ends up leading to what to me is the scariest scene in the movie, and it's one of the scariest scenes I've ever seen in a horror film because it is so plainly done that she ends up – she runs away. She runs out of the office, and she makes her way down into a subway car. And, you know, this is in the middle of the night when New York is still running because, you know, New York is up and moving – people are up and moving around at 3 in the morning. And she gets on this train, and she's looking over her shoulder, and these two guys get on. And they're in, like, top hats and coats, and they look like sophisticated sort of society types, which is funny. They're getting on a subway at 3 in the morning. But this is when the subways were clean and everything else, and the subways are still kind of new. And they're in the and between them is a third guy, and he's got a hat pulled over his face because he's clearly drunk, and they're holding up their friend. And they're kind of – they're constantly trying to – they keep playing with his hat, trying to kind of sort of obscure his face a little, and they're just trying to keep him conscious. So then they sit down in the seats, and one of them – bumps the hat and the hat falls off and we see that the guy in the middle is not in fact drunk. It's the corpse of Irving August.
Yeah.
And Mary notices this and just as she notices it, those guys notice that she's noticed and they both look.
Yeah. They're no longer drunk. Yeah.
And they all of a sudden stop being drunk. That scene is so terrifying to me. I've seen 1,000 horror movies that collectively cannot build up to what this scene does.
No, I agree. And that's, again, that's all part of the sort of understated Lewton aesthetic that, I mean, it shocks you just by showing you people that aren't drunk suddenly.
it's relatively, you know, simple. And I have to think a lot of this is due to the work of the DP, who was a guy named Nicholas Musaraka, who really casts these amazing shadows in this film. I mean, it has a very... New York has a very German expressionist feel to it with these like looming skyscrapers and all the doorways seem to like, you know, you've seen buildings in New York where, you know, the door, the entryway are inset. And, you know, in this film, doorways to these buildings look like they're just the inky blackness. I mean, there's like, no, you know, you could just disappear into these shadows. They're so stark. And I think it is one of Lewton's best-looking films. Even though Musaraka, I think, did some of Lewton's other films, this one, he really knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I mean, RKO was known in the 40s as the House of Noir, right? So, they had the people on hand to tell those stories. And this is, you know, pre-noir, basically, but right on the cusp.
Yeah, this is – I mean, it's we can get into this a little bit, but this film was not a success at the box office because it was during the war. People did not surprisingly want to hear about – as Lewton put it, he said the message of this movie is death is good. And surprisingly, during when you've got a world where the headlines are full of stories about people dying overseas, I really don't want to pay my 12 cents and have my popcorn to be told that death is good. That's just not what I'm interested in. And the whole end up sort of gist of this movie is that Jacqueline is, I mean, am I wrong? I think she's just depressed, right? Because she basically wants to end her life, but she can't quite bring herself to do it, which is why she gets mixed up with the Satanists.
Her backstory, you know, which we get almost none of, is, you know, it would be interesting to have someone do a prequel. Like, this is a businesswoman running a successful cosmetics concern who hooks up with a bunch of Satanists, I guess, in a moment of despair. And then tires of their influence and, you know, tries to go the psychiatric route or psychoanalytic route. And meanwhile, she's gotten engaged to the dad from Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah, Hugh Beaumont, TV's dad, yeah, America's
dad. She found a way to get involved with him while all of this is going on. And then she just sort of, she's on a trajectory towards death. And it's all, I guess, in Luton's mind, it's all about, you know, her trying to find... It's like Batman in a Frank Miller story, like looking for a good death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's really, I mean, considering that she is, in fact, the titular seventh victim, Jean Brooks as Jacqueline does not get much dialogue.
No, really. But what she does get is pretty amazing. Like, the scene where they're trying to force her to drink the poison is, that's another unforgettable one for me, for sure. All she says is, like, no, no. Like, she's grunting. I won't drink. And, it's a sort of up to everyone else around her to do the emotional hysterics. And they come through. Isabel Jewell does anyway, her friend.
Yeah, Isabel Jewell plays her friend Frances, who clearly, they can't say it because it's 1943. But it's pretty clear she's in love with Jacqueline.
Yeah,
not just as a best friend, but flat out in love. And you know, the wig they gave Jean Brooks is this stark black wig with these great bangs that come across, and she looks not too much like Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah,
and
for
it's
sure.
An amazing. She looks just great in the movie. I mean, she just cuts an amazing figure every time you see her, because she's in these long black coats. I mean, she looks like the specter of death. In this movie, she was a natural blonde, so I mean, it was quite a change to make her look that way. But boy, she looks terrific in this movie.
Yeah, another sad Hollywood story, unfortunately.
Oh, I don't know what happened to Jean Brooks.
Well, I don't know too many of the details, but I mean, her career didn't endure far beyond this movie, really.
Oh,
and
okay.
She died of, you know, the coroner's report listed alcoholism and malnutrition in her 40s. So,
oh my goodness! Oh, that's
so many stories like that. But
wow, I didn't know it. Yeah, she's terrific in this movie, and so is I mentioned him at the top of the show. Tom Conway as Dr. Judd. He is the most icky. I mean, he's a psychiatrist that talks about that we know that he slept with his patient. I think it's pretty obvious that he's done that. And he is such an oily piece of garbage in this movie. And he's an oily piece of garbage in Cat People, too.
Well, the amazing thing is that this is a step up for him. He's less terrible in this movie. I mean, death was good for him because he's dead at the end of Cat People. And now he's back.
Right, which makes this a prequel to Cat People.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I don't know. Or, you know, it's just another reality for him to have a shot at doing something decent for once, and he kind of does, but it takes him a while to build up to it. One of my favorite scenes with him is near the beginning, where he's sort of introduced as this famous, he's no longer practicing, he says, so he's written a book, and this secretary at Hugh Beaumont's firm wants his advice about her dad, who's an alcoholic. And Tom Conway's just like, I don't want to help your dad. I'm more interested in theory now than in practice. And then he just sort of adds as this little knife twist. He's like, dipsomania is rather sordid. And just leaves the room like, that's his mic drop moment. Like, have fun with your sordid drunk dad. Like,
Tom Conway was great at delivering withering insults, very similar to his brother, George Sanders, who, of course, was sort of a bigger success. And George Sanders played – for anybody listening to this that's like a comic book nerd, he, of course, played Mr. Freeze on Batman in one episode. Conway is great in this, and he's very – you're right. He's worse than Cat People. So it's probably good that he gets what's coming to him. In that film,
he needed killing in that one for sure.
That's right. Yes, he has a unique relationship in this film with another character named Jason, who was a poet, and played by a guy named Erford Gage. And Erford Gage is this kind of doofy guy. It's sort of funny again how much of Mary is much more capable, because Jason is the ostensible love interest for Mary, and he is just not up to her level.
No.
In any way. I mean, and in a traditional movie, he would be the lead character. But it's a Valud movie. It's not traditional. So they think they really present him as the kind of hapless kind of guy that he is. I mean, he's completely out of his depth in this story. And, you know, probably New York entirely. And he's out of his depth with Mary, certainly.
Yeah. No, he's... that's a really strange character. I kind of like him. He's his off-kilter delivery of things, and he's constantly being accused of being funny by the Italian woman that runs the restaurant, but he's not funny. And he, you know, he's always correcting her. I'm a poet. I'm not a comedian, but she thinks of the same thing for some reason. But he does have his big shining detective moment where he goes to the library.
That's right. That's right. And he flirts with the librarian.
He sweet talks his way into getting a glimpse at the library cards of some pertinent figures and finds his way into the nest of the Satanists. That's the best he can do.
Yeah, the Satanists, it's interesting. Some of the backstory of this thing is that apparently the screenwriters are Charles O'Neill and DeWitt Bodine. DeWitt Bodine, mm-hmm. when he got the assignment, apparently looked into visiting actual Satanists, which he was hooked up with through RKO's production office. They just had that information.
Sure, why like, not?
Some secretary's like, oh yeah, we can hook you up with some Satanists. Yeah, no problem. So he meets with actual Satanists, and they were just a bunch of old ditties that sat around knitting while speaking incantations to Satan.
Yeah.
in a sort of, you wouldn't expect this of Satanists, but they were apparently all praying for the death of Hitler. So they were using their powers for good, which is why in this film, the Satanists are kind of a bunch of old people. They sit around and they have these parties. There's this one character who's a one-armed piano player, which is just sort of a random detail of like, okay, I don't know what that's about. But the Satanists here don't seem terribly threatening because they don't want to. They can't kill anybody, or they refuse.
Now they're pledged to nonviolence.
Right.
Yeah.
Now they'll hire a quote unquote hitman, and the hitman himself isn't going to kill Jacqueline. He's just trying to force her to kill herself. So it's like they're Satanists, but they're kind of gentle Satanists. It's a very, very, very odd.
Now, it's an interesting concept, and I wouldn't have known that this was Satanist protocol, but maybe – I guess they picked this up from the people they actually met, that they were afraid to exert force in the world lest it lead to good. Anyway, that's the excuse they give in the movie for not committing any acts of violence.
I've always sort of felt like this film is an unofficial earlier universe movie to Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, in Rosemary's Baby, you've got a bunch of elderly Satanists located in the village, in the Greenwich Village of New York City, and that's what you've got here. So
yeah.
I feel like, well, okay, these Satanists that are in The Seventh Victim just kept going on and just kept being Satanists, and then eventually, you know, the world got a little tougher, and so they decided to get a little more proactive, as they do with Rosemary's Baby. But I mean, this film really has a lot in common. I wonder if Roman Polanski didn't see this movie.
I feel like he must have, or else he met the same group of Satanists that inspired DeWitt Bodine.
There you go. Yeah. Oh, hello, Roman. Yeah.
You were still kicking around 20 years later.
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
One of the other things in this film that is interesting is that there's a lot of duality. Well, there's a lot of numerology in this film, you know, period. I mean, first of all, the apartment that Jacqueline has is room 7. Mm-hmm. There's the Satanists have a mark, which is this parallelogram inside of a square. And if you add up the sides of a square and a parallelogram, you get 7. And there's lots of duels. There's lots of two sets of people. You've got, again, you mentioned Hugh Beaumont and Jason. They're kind of a duo. And then you've got Jacqueline and Mary. They're a duo. You've got Jacqueline and her friend Francis. They're a duo. Every character here has some sort of, not a doppelganger, but an alternate story. Now, I can't profess to exactly know what all that means exactly, but I can't help but notice it.
Yeah, I think, again, that sort of leads back to the idea of a dream logic to the narrative, right? Because it doesn't proceed by any rational logic.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it does seem like the sort of torch of consciousness or protagonisthood is being passed from one character to the next throughout the movie until they can get to this conclusion of, you know, a good death. But, it's like it's sort of feeling its way through the different possibilities for the right moment to strike with Luton's, moral that he wants to impart to people.
Mm. Now, there's a really wonderful scene as well, another scary scene, a shower scene, which predates Psycho by a good 15 years, where one of the Pallidists goes to visit Mary, to tell her basically, hey, stop following us around. And it's not as explicit or as action-packed as the Psycho scene is, but it's definitely creepy because you're in the shower with Mary when all of a sudden you see this shadowy figure appear on the shower curtain, and you never see this person talking, you just hear them.
Yeah.
Mary, it's really creepy. What did you think of that scene?
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. No, I feel like it had to have had some sort of influence on Hitchcock. I mean, I don't know if that's ever been verified, but yeah, it's a very disturbing scene too, because this is where she doesn't get attacked, but she's informed in that scene that her sister is a murderess. She is the one that stabbed Irving August.
Right.
So, it has real stakes, too. It's like, she starts to, just say, get out of my bathroom. I'm not going to do what you tell me to do. But then she's sort of cowed by this bit of information that's passed on to her by the leader, one of the leaders of the satanic cult.
Yeah.
That, they were holding Jacqueline hostage like a pent-up animal, and Irving August burst in there at the wrong moment and got stabbed for his troubles. Mm. So, yeah, she's this sister relationship is headed for trouble no matter what. I mean, she's no longer trying to rescue her sister from being a prisoner somewhere. She's trying to see if she can get the best deal, like a plea bargain for her or something. I mean, which is where Hugh Beaumont comes back in, because he's a lawyer.
Right.
And he's mysteriously transferred his affections from Jacqueline to Mary. Like, all of this, you don't really see it happen. You just, Jason the poet tells us that it has happened. And presumably it happened on scripted scenes that were never filmed, or certainly not in the movie, where, the transfer of affection happens. But there's one scene, like one major scene between Mary and I forget what his name is, actually, Hugh Beaumont's character.
Oh, it's Gregory Ward.
Oh, Gregory Ward, yes. So he's like trying to get her to buck up, and he gets her a job. And you know, the scene where he tells her to drink her milk and she just is like, gets steely eyed and says, I don't like people ordering me what to do. And it's an amazing moment there too. Again, like you just don't see scenes like that between men and women in movies from that era.
Yeah. Oh, that is a great scene where she stands up for herself again, but it's not a big moment. It's just kind of like, hey, I don't want people to tell me what to do. Luton clearly liked female protagonists.
Oh, he
because
definitely
Cat
did,
People,
yeah.
The main character is a female, and I Walk with a Zombie. Not so much the Leopard Man, but there's a main character. I mean, he was very, he clearly was a sympathetic writer-producer to people of all types. It wasn't just guys. I mean, he was one of the first people to have minorities in his films that were not, stereotypical, obsequious servant types. I mean, he really was sort of an equal opportunity guy. It's funny you mentioned that Mary gets the job at the school. We only see her teaching the kids for one scene. And even in that scene, there's something creepy, because she's got a book out to a bunch of – and these are like little kids, like wee little, like 4 or 5-year-olds. And she's reading them a book, and it's some sort of sing-songy book, and the phone rings. And as she gets up, she starts trailing off the song, and the song is something like something, 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 I'll put you to bed. And then the final verse is, here comes a chopper to chop off your head.
Yeah, I
Who
know.
Who sings it's that like to children? Like, what are you talking about?
I don't know. It sounds like something from Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol.
Like, what the hell?
No, I think she should be fired. I think she needs to look into a different kind of work, because that's I would have been very upset if my kindergarten teacher had sung that song,
yeah,
I think.
Oh, my Lord. And speaking of weird jobs, there's one other character we haven't really mentioned yet, and that is the neighbor who lives next to Jacqueline. She is played by Elizabeth Russell, who was quite the favorite of Val Lewton. She appears in – she's the one in Cat People who is the Catwoman, basically, and has that really powerful scene where she sees the main character and says that Muli Sestra thing.
Yeah.
You know, and she was in Curse of the Cat People. I mean, Val Lewton really loved her. And do you – I mean, I get the sense that when we see Elizabeth Russell, she's ill. She's deathly ill. Mm-hmm. And I get the sense that she – they seem to hint around the edges that she's maybe a prostitute of some sort and she's got some sort of disease that you would get from being a prostitute. They seem to hint it that way. They can't actually say it.
Yeah, it certainly seems possible. Like, yeah, my diagnosis was always like tuberculosis.
Oh,
which
that's true.
You could get it a bunch of different ways. But yeah, you definitely get the sense that she's probably been leading some kind of underworld life up to that point. And that's why she's stuck in this seedy restaurant apartment with no one to care for her as she dies slowly.
Yeah, it's really very tragic. And the film ends with Jacqueline ends up making it back to her. I mean, we're ruining it a little, but we, you know, you should see it anyway because, you know, it's all about how they do it and not what happens.
Yeah, I would say it's spoiler-proof in a way.
Yeah. I mean, the film ends with Jacqueline going back to her apartment, and she runs into Elizabeth Russell, and the Elizabeth Russell's character says, well, changes her mind and says something basically the effect of, I'm not just going to lay around in my apartment waiting to die. I'm going to go out and live. I'm going to go out and live every moment. And when the last time we see her, and she gets the final scene in the movie, which is sort of remarkable for a minor character, she's dressed up. She's got a beautiful evening gown on, and her makeup's on, and her hair is done up, and she's going to go out, and she's going to go out and live. And then we hear the thunk.
Yeah.
From behind the door of Jacqueline's apartment, indicating that Jacqueline has finally, in fact, done herself in. And it's just, again, with the duality of that you've got a character who is facing death, and she doesn't want it, and she's doing the best she can to fight it off. And here you've got Jacqueline, who seems to be, as you mentioned, had a successful business, has a sister that clearly loves her, has had a fiancé, had a lot of things, and yet is just wants to die. She just wants to. So you've got this one woman who would trade paces with Jacqueline in a minute if she could.
Yeah, I guess I don't. I mean, that exchange is so enigmatic, and you know, you can watch it over and over again, and you'll think different things every time. Maybe I don't know. I mean, it seems like, and I guess some of the things that happen leading up to it, maybe Lewton saying that you know, something as simple as you can only appreciate life when you're on the verge of death. I mean, right? Because, I mean, the only person who shows, like, a great will to live in this movie is Elizabeth Russell. She heads out possibly to die on the dance floor from consumption. Like, I mean, she's going to overtax herself and collapse, for sure.
Right, yeah.
But
she's
ready.
Fragile, yeah.
She's ready to do it.
And film ends with her descending this staircase, and then we fade to black, and you're like, wow, that's the end of this movie?
It.
And even Mary doesn't really get much of a resolution to her story. I mean, you know that she'll eventually figure out that Jacqueline has killed herself, but considering that Mary's the main character, she sort of shuffled off at a good I mean, for the movie's only 70 minutes, but I don't think you see Mary for, like, the last – what, 15? Do you?
She's in that last scene. She has – it's probably just a few minutes before the end where she and Hugh Beaumont –
oh, that's right, where Jacqueline does go in. All right. That's right.
Like, they're talking – like, so they – Hugh Beaumont reveals that he loves Mary, and she's like, yes, I know you do. I'm glad you told me, but we can't act on this because we've got to think of Jacqueline. And we never see how they react when Jacqueline – is it to Jacqueline's death. I mean, it's...
Yeah, just hear the thunk.
Wow. No, it's a very audacious film, and it needed to be a B film for sure. So I'm glad he was loyal to Mark Robeson.
Yeah, I mean, it would never work as an A-level film, and they said you wonder if, like, did anybody at RKO pay attention to this movie, or they were just happy that, you know, well, we wanted you to call the movie The Seventh Victim, and you called it The Seventh Victim. And if you look at the posters, if the poster really plays up, there's really only one action, quote-unquote, action scene in the whole movie, which is when the Palladist assassin chases Jacqueline through the streets of New York. That's the scene on the poster. They make it seem like that's the whole movie when it's, good lord, it's probably 30 seconds. The whole movie is this creepy-looking guy in a big dark hat, and he's chasing Jacqueline. And Jacqueline only gets rescued when she stumbles upon a bunch of actors that are
– who are totally insensitive. Yeah. I mean, they're like, come drink with us. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, they're just wrapping up a play. I mean, this is another movie that really – I think has a good – this is like a great New York movie.
It is.
You know,
it
really gives you a sense of like the nightlife of New York, that it's quite truly the city that never sleeps.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like, well, we know that it definitely is one of Scorsese's favorites, so it's sort
is
of...
Is it? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's a big Luton fan.
I knew he was Luton. I don't think I'd ever seen that he actually mentioned, like, this film in particular. Oh, that's great. That makes me feel great.
Yeah, and De Palma, too. I mean, I've never heard De Palma talk about this movie, but I feel like some of his films are drawing on this imagery, for sure. Like, there are scenes in Dress to Kill and Blowout that are these sort of nocturnal ramble scenes that definitely evoke this.
Interesting.
So, I mean, yeah, I'd like to know if he actually ever cited this as an influence, but I feel like it has to be.
Huh. One other movie that I think has some connection to The Seventh Victim, and again, I've never been able to verify it, is the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers by Philip Kaufman, which we covered on Film and Water way back, like episode 12 or something. And because there are two characters in that movie, one by a psychiatrist played by Leonard Nimoy, and this sort of artsy guy played by Jeff Goldblum, and they have a very similar dynamic in that movie that Jason the poet and Dr. Judd have here, because Jason is sort of constantly like kissing up to Dr. Judd, and he's trying to get him published, and he, you know, maybe you could get my poems in front of your publisher. And they have that kind of obsequious relationship, which is the very similar relationship to the ones that Nimoy and Goldblum have in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And those characters do not exist in the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Right.
So that was an addition by the screenwriter W.D. Richter and Philip Kaufman. So Philip Kaufman, I would geek out because I love his movies. But I think if I could think of it, I would ask him, because it just seems like such a strange addition.
Yeah.
To that movie, considering that the original does not have that relationship. And of course, that movie's a very San Francisco movie. You can transpose a lot of the events in Seventh Victim to Invasion of the Body Snatchers in terms of this creepy thing happening right before your eyes in a big city.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a good deal of sense. So that is a very interesting double act that they've got going there.
Yeah, they're
in
terrific.
Both movies.
In
Seventh Victim, like, that's another of the million stories, like backstories to this thing, is that Jason, the poet, stopped writing poetry 10 years ago because he lost his great love, who was last seen with Dr. Judd.
Right.
Full time. So there was this sort of seething animosity between the two of them at once. And then they have this big reconciliation moment when Dr. Judd reveals that Jason's former paramour is in an insane asylum, and he calls her a horrible raving thing, which is more sensitive talk from Dr. Jeff. But this is like a big moment of cementing their friendship, or, you know, resealing their friendship, because he was keeping this knowledge from Jason all these years to protect him or something.
Very odd. Yeah. Like kind of what we talked about at the top of the show, and I think you spoke to it very, very well, and that it is the messiness of this film that I think keeps it interesting in a lot of ways. I think if everything had been tied up in a nice little bow, it wouldn't be as disturbing. But the fact that these characters sort of randomly smash into one another, and it kind of just gives it that messy, weird, unsettled feeling. And that's what I come away from. Because, like, you know, I talked about the scene in the shower and the scene on the subway. Those are all very scary scenes. You know, I think by probably modern horror movie audiences, they're not scary.
Just the dread.
Yeah, the dread. Right.
Yeah, the dread is palpable, and it's just ongoing in it, and it's going to outlast the film by, you know, it doesn't end with the end of the film. And that's another thing, having all those loose threads. I mean, these lives, you can't help but imagine what's going to happen afterwards, because there just isn't this sort of three-act structure to the movie at all.
Yes.
It just feels like this unfinished symphony of, grim Luton ramblings about life.
That's a good way to describe the show, the grim ramblings. Yeah. In terms of Val Luton movies, like, where do you place this? Is this your favorite one of his?
I think it's my favorite. I also really love Curse of the Cat People.
Weird one. A really, even by his standards, yeah. That's another weird movie.
Yeah, it's a wonderful Christmas movie. It's got an incredible, maybe my favorite child actor performance in any film that I can think of.
It's Ann Carter, I think her name was. She's terrific in the movie. And yeah. Another movie that started a career. That was the first film of Robert Wise, who went on to one of the great Hollywood careers. I mean, as good as Mark Robeson was, and he was, like I mentioned, he did Von Ryan's Express, he did Earthquake, Peyton Place, Valley of the Dolls, The End of the Sixth Happiness, The Bridges of Toko Rhee. I mean, one really great film. I mean, that's nothing compared to Robert Wise. Robert Wise is probably, you could argue, one of the 20 great directors of all time, and he got his start thanks to Val Luton.
Yeah, it's true. No, this was a real factory for talented professionals coming out of that. Sort of, they did editing, and they learned all the different, you know, behind the scenes trades, and then graduated to director. And yeah, I mean, as much as I would like to stand up for Mark Robeson, because he's also a Montrealer, as I am, but his career doesn't quite... Although his career has a lot of these little gems, too, that I've discovered over the years. And, kind of subversive little... Or at least, progressive films. Like Land of the Brave. Is it Home of the Brave? I think Home of the Brave,
yeah.
Which is, it's about an African-American soldier. I mean, he's the protagonist of the movie. It's 1949. You just don't see too many movies like that. And another one that I don't know if anybody loves as much as I do is a movie called I Want You, which is set during the Korean War. It was made during the Korean War, and it's about a family torn apart because one, Farley Granger, who's the sort of younger son in this family dynamic, does not want to go die in Korea. And the movie, it hedges its bets. I mean, it's got people with all different perspectives on this, but you definitely don't feel like he's completely wrong. Like, you understand why he doesn't want to do this. I mean, even if it ultimately tries to put pressure on him to do it anyway.
Huh.
But yeah, it's a really interesting movie. Yeah, it's got, Dana Andrews, Dorothy McGuire, all kinds of, it's a Samuel Goldwyn movie. I think it's 1951. I don't know how easy it is to see. I had it on VHS.
And I managed
to transfer it over the years.
I'll have to try and find it. That does sound really interesting. Yeah, they all went on to do interesting stuff. And unfortunately for Val Luton, he kind of had a rough life after he was done at RKO. And he bounced around from studio to studio. And he never really could get things. He just didn't have the freedom that he had at RKO. And he never really produced anything terribly great after that. There's a very sad story about, I think, when he went over to MGM and he was at MGM and a reporter was interviewing the head of the studio. I'm probably getting the studio wrong, but it was that guy, Dory Sherry, who's the head of the studio. And the reporters said something to the effect of, well, you have, you guys, you just hired one of the greatest directors working for your studio. And Dory Sherry had no idea who he was talking about. And the reporter had to feed him the name. He's like, Val Luton? And, oh, yeah, okay. And it was like, oh, wow. And so, he kind of had a hard life and he died very young. He did produce one other movie that I want to mention just as a quick little aside, because we're never going to get to it on the show proper. The last film he ever did was a Western called Apache Drums, which is in color. And again, you would think that as Stephen McNally, Colleen Gray from Leech Woman and these other like genre movies.
But it
is absolutely a Val Lewton movie in terms of its mood, because there is this amazing sequence where a bunch of these people are a bunch of these sort of, you know, cowboys and you know, members of this Western town are trapped in this barn surrounded by Apaches, and the Apaches start beating their drums in like this sort of death march, and all you hear is like the dum 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 dum, and the people inside know they're going to die, and it is amazingly intense, and you're like, it's basically a horror movie scene inside of a Western.
Interesting.
And it's directed by a guy named Hugo Fragonese, who I'm not that familiar with, but
no,
you absolutely see Val Lewton. If you didn't know, you wouldn't know, but once you know it's a Val Lewton movie and then you watch it, you go, oh yeah, this is a Val Lewton movie, because it just has that sense of dread of like death is – you know, you people are living in the frontier. Death is all around. It doesn't take much. And so it's a terrific little movie, and much as you just recommended your movie, I would say if you could ever find Apache Drums, give it a shot, because it's a great little movie and a nice it's a great way for if Val Lewton had to die young, unfortunately he did, he went out on a winner, I would say.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I think that's the only Lewton involved movie that I haven't seen, so I will have to try to find it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So anybody listening to this who's not familiar with Val Lewton, you may have heard of Cat People. So far, it's the only film of his that's ever been remade. Not a great remake. It does have
It has some moments, for sure.
It does have Naked Annette O'Toole in it, and I can, by definition, never knock any film that has Naked Annette O'Toole in it, but yeah, it's overwrought, I would say, when you compare it to the original.
Control.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like Paul Schrader, but I don't know what he was doing there.
Yeah, a little much. But these films are great. They're all very short. I mean, they're all like 70, 75 minutes, even the ones he later did with Boris Karloff. And I think they're all universally pretty good. Even the ones that are not great are interesting in their weirdness. Like The Ghost Ship, I would say, is probably – or Isle of the Dead are probably his least successful.
I love Isle of the Dead.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know how well I could defend it either, but it really has that consistent, ominous feel to it you wouldn't get in most B movies from that era. I mean, it really, just interesting to see Ellen Drew, who I mostly know from light comedies, playing someone suspected of being a vampire.
Yeah, it's amazing. The one last thing I will mention about Val Lewton, just because, again, I don't know when we're going to get to another Val Lewton movie, is Lewton absolutely turned up his nose at Universal. He thought the Universal horror movies were garbage for kids. And, you know, you could argue that by the time they got to the Monster Rally movies, they were for kids. But he really thought that they were just, you know, piffle. And he was going to show them up by producing these very literate movies. And, of course, in the end, you know, those movies, the Universal movies made a lot of money, and his movies – and especially the later ones didn't make a ton of money, so he, you know, I think he was probably bitter about that. But apparently, at some point, RKO wanted to make a quote unquote Monster Rally movie of the Val Lewton movies and have cat people and leopard men and zombies and the ghost ship. And I read a book about Val Lewton, and the guy, the author, said, you know, when I first discovered this little factoid in some RKO, memorandum, I thought, that's got to be nonsense. There's no way you could make a Monster Rally movie out of the Val Lewton universe. And yet, later on, as he was working on the book, he found a early pre-production poster the movie. And it was called, They Come at Night or something. And it was basically somebody in the art department just took pieces from all the Val Lewton movie posters and just slapped them together in one poster. And there it is. There's the poster. And it's like, so they were actually at some point going to force Val Lewton to make a Monster Rally movie, which would have been amazing, because he would have been so pissed off having to make that movie.
I'd never heard that. That's amazing.
If I can find that poster online, I'll send you the link.
Please do send it.
You're like, you're just picturing how angry he would have been if he had to make that movie with like cat people running into the zombies and running into the leopard man and all this kind of crazy stuff. So, but anyway, I highly recommend any of Val Lewton's movies. I think The Seventh Victim is one of my all-time favorite movies. It's one of my all-time favorite horror movies. I don't know anyone else has seen it. And David, I really appreciate you volunteering to come on and talk to me about this. I really wanted to end Halloween with a good one, and this is a good one. So I really enjoyed talking to you, and I really appreciate you coming on to discuss the film with me.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, thank you so much. Where can people find you on the internet?
I used to do a lot of blogging, but that's kind of fallen by the wayside. But I do have a couple of podcasts that, you know, we do about one a month. I do them with my girlfriend, Elise. One of them is called Another Kind of Distance, a time travel podcast. So we talk about usually two time travel movies per episode. And we've done about 45 of them now, so there's a good backlog there. We've done a lot of, you know, the ones you'd expect, and then some that are totally off most people's radars. So, and the other one that we started recently is Ben Days of Our Lives, which is subtitled A Comics Nostalgia Podcast.
What a title. That is a fantastic, I just got it. That's a fantastic title, David. Yeah,
so we're kind of playing up there the fact that we were both really into comics in the 80s, and we were primarily into the soap opera aspects of comics, superhero comics. So we're revisiting some things that we both loved, or in some cases we both loved them in the 80s. In other cases, she's introducing me to things that she read that I never got around to, and then vice versa. So we did the first few episodes on the early issues of Wolfman and Perez's New Teen Titans.
Ah, yes.
And the next episode we're going to be recording is going to be about Amethyst, the maxi series.
Ooh, okay.
Which I've never read, but I'm looking forward to it because I've always liked Ernie Colon's art.
And, me too.
So I think it's going to be interesting.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you again. Thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it, and I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Well, everybody, if you want to follow the show, of course, it's on our website, which is the network website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And you can follow the show over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So we wish everybody a happy Halloween, happy and safe Halloween. Go get your candy and enjoy. And we'll be back next week. So until then, that's a wrap.
Seventh Victim, I think, has two of the great scenes. One of them really anticipated Psycho, didn't it, DeWitt?
Yes, it did. The scene in the bathroom Newton, the employer, comes in to see Kim Hunter. She appears.
Mrs. Reddy was her name.
And she, Kim Hunter is taking a shower, and they speak with the shower going and through the shower, as a matter
looking
of fact.
Looking out.
Out, and you only see the shadow of the woman on the shower curtain. And it's very horrifying, really. There's a menace in it.
Us. She was asking about us.
Caro mio ben, credi il mio
Mary.
Oh, I'll help you out in a minute.
That won't be necessary. I haven't much to say. If I were you, Mary, I'd go back to school. I'd make no further attempt to find Jacqueline.